Barbara Elliott is our next speaker. She's the president of the Center for Renewal and author of the book Street Saints, Renewing American Cities. She's been an international TV correspondent covering economic and political news for PBS in Europe, and she served my old boss, Ronald Reagan, the White House Office of Public Liaison. Miss Elliott.
Thanks very much. I miss our old boss, don't you? Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. A number of you old friends in the Philadelphia Society and some of you new friends. I'm going to take a totally different tack on the subject at hand. And rather than addressing what is taking place at the political level, I'm going to speak from the perspective of what's going on in civil society. That is an area that I have been focusing on for the last pretty close to 20 years now. I'm also speaking as someone who has lived in Houston for the last 11 years. It's an interesting place in that we are a border state and a very full city, 39% Hispanic right now. And I'm also speaking from the perspective of someone who is focused on civil society, but also poverty issues as well, both as an analyst and a practitioner. I started a group in Houston just about 2 years ago now that is ushering people into unemployment, and a number of them are immigrants to the country, legally working here, but nevertheless, folks who are struggling to make an existence. I've also been planting partnerships for mentoring at-risk children in public elementary schools throughout the country. We have 7,000 mentors now. And many of the children that we're mentoring, myself included, are children of immigrants, and they have been born in this country, but they're coming from a Latino background, including the little 8-year-old I see every week. I've written about some of these issues in Street Saints and articles since. I've advised philanthropists on a variety of models that can be implemented in the private sector. So my remarks are really coming out of that context. And while many of the issues that you've been talking about throughout the last day and a half have been dealing with the economy per se, what I'd like to talk about is from the America's perspective, how do we turn immigrants to this country into assets rather than liabilities? What I'd like to do is look at the issues that are strengthening immigrants that we have in this country now in America who are staying here, and what are the pressures that they are exerting on our institutions here, and what's being done in the private sector which can alleviate those pressures. I'm also going to look briefly at some of the things that can be done to alleviate the pressures to emigrate in the first place. And again, private sector solutions taking place in civil society, which are to some extent alleviating that push to come here in the first place. Whatever the next administration does or doesn't do in changing our immigration laws, we still have 38.4 million immigrants in America, according to the World Bank migration study. One out of every eight people living in the U.S. And even if the 12 million undocumented workers were to vanish tomorrow, which they will not, we still have a significant number of them who are here, who are either going to be assets or liabilities for our nation. I address some of these issues in Philanthropy magazine, and some of my remarks today have been adapted from that article that appeared there. Particularly now with our economy in turmoil and those economies of our Latin American neighbors, we need to think prudently about how to maximize the impact of potential assets that we have here. And I'd like to tell you about some of these private sector efforts that are doing just that. Good solutions in the private sector could actually strengthen both those who are here in America and our Latin American neighbors at the same time. Love, war, and work. These are the three reasons that most people immigrate, according to Marcelo Suarez Orozco. He is the head of Harvard's immigration project, or he was the head of it before he went to NYU, where he founded the Institute for Globalization and Education. He's devoted a career to studying immigration, and love, war, and work are the three things that he has seen again and again when he looks at the reasons that people leave. A country is ravaged by war. People flee. Family members want to be reunited with members of their family. They go for love. People emigrate to work when the situation is so bleak in their own country, they have no prospects. The current immigration phenomenon, however, is a worldwide phenomenon, according to Suarez Orozco. He says there are 185 million immigrants on the move worldwide. and the largest immigratory wave in all of time. This is affecting not just the United States, but the world. The man-made disasters of poverty and war have joined in natural disasters in moving millions of people over continents, across the 20th and into the 21st century. Now, assimilating immigrants into the United States is not a new phenomenon. We've done this a number of times in America before. What was largely built on British roots in this country in the 17th and 18th centuries has successfully assimilated waves of German, Irish, Italian, Hungarian, and Greek immigrants, each wave of which created pressures in our institutions here, and each wave of which was assimilated at some point in our schools, in our cities. Through the 19th and into the 20th century, many of these newcomers arrived here having little education, did not speak English, and usually in the course of two generations were sufficiently integrated. However, the question is now, can America assimilate this time the large wave that has come with a different set of circumstances and a large, large piece to digest all at once? One of the problems that we have in looking at the immigration issue, and I say this from a city now that is 39% Hispanic, where 100 languages are spoken in our schools, the schools which were to be the instrument of assimilation and acculturation are now being stretched to their capacity. Right now, the Houston Independent School District has 100 languages spoken there. 9% of the children in HISD are Anglo children. It makes it a real challenge to educate when you're dealing with not just Spanish as a predominant language, but with many other languages as well. So, how do we assimilate this new wave of people from all over the world, but many of them from Latin American countries? I would suggest that where it's been done well, it's always been in the civic sector. For the most part, the hearth of America, really, in communicating culture is in our schools, our churches, our communities. Civil society is the hearth of the culture, and this is where the personal interaction takes place that allows people to come to understand the nation to which they have come, skills that they are acquiring, relationships in which they are rooted, make them strong and contributing citizens. However, learning the English language is one of the prerequisites. There seems to be a great deal of concern on whether or not that's going to take place, but in fact, Suarez Orozco, who did a longitudinal study of immigrants to this country, has concluded that 99% of the children who he interviewed said that learning English was one of their highest priorities. We have to understand more than the language, however. It is really necessary to understand the heart of America in a deeper sense in order to be a participant. James Wilson, who signed our Constitution, observed, "Law and liberty cannot rationally become the objects of our love until they become the objects of our knowledge." Learning enough to pass the civics exam is not enough. That is one hurdle, but it certainly should not be the only one. The essence of meaningful participation in American life revolves around several crucial factors: language, education, employment, and family. The matrix of relationships that are fostered in those institutions will be those things that constitute the fabric of civil society. Since the 1990s, about 1 million immigrants have been coming to the U.S. every year. That includes both legal and illegal. Two-thirds of them are coming for family reunification. The others are coming for a variety of reasons. Now, obviously, the shift of the composition of these waves has changed. In 1880, 97% of them came from Europe. 1990, a quarter came from Europe, another quarter from Asia, 43% from Latin America. By 1995, most of them were coming without permission, a majority of them. That's a problem, and most of those who have been coming without permission are from Mexico alone. There's another little subset of that group, and that is the children of illegal immigrants who have been born legally in this country, including the little girl that I am mentoring. 3 million of them in this nation. They are now Americans, although their parents may never be. What do we do to take those children and to turn them into assets for the country in which they have now citizenship? Obviously, labor needs in this country and the absence of labor opportunities in other countries have driven the influx. The employers in Texas, those in Houston, that you know all about, are saying, or have been saying until very recently, there are acute needs in construction, roofing, masonry, service industries, food preparation, and nursing. The labor needs have been the invitation for people to come here. Unlike the shrinking population in Europe, we've actually had a growing population in the United States, largely fueled by immigrants. However, all of that being said, there are real costs associated with the immigrants who have come here, and short of an overhaul in legislation, which I do not see in the near future in our country, something has to happen in the private sector that is in a position to respond prudently. I'd suggest that two of the institutions that are struggling most under this burden are the schools and the hospitals, but more about this in a moment. Looking at education, Alexis de Tocqueville observed, the bond of language is perhaps the strongest and most lasting that unite men. Obviously, the immigrants need to learn English. We talked about that a little bit earlier. Just to give you some stats, by the second generation, half of Latino immigrants are English dominant and the rest are bilingual. By the third generation, 80% are English dominant. Yes, there are pockets of our cities where English is scarcely spoken, but it is almost always a first generation phenomenon. At least according to the studies that have been done on it, the language issue is being overcome by the second generation. However, the education issue is an even more critical one. A century ago, it was possible to come here from Europe. The story of the honest Irish workman who would come here and work at a blue-collar job and work his way up into some kind of management. That no longer exists. We now have an hourglass economy, lots of low-skill jobs, a very narrow STEM, and then knowledge industry jobs at the top. In the absence of a high school diploma, it is impossible to go from the lower level up this STEM. Now, here are some alarming statistics. The dropout rate nationally is about 50% in our public high schools. In Houston, only 30% of the Hispanic students who are there are graduating from high school. It doesn't take a lot of imagination to imagine what kind of a future they're going to have. Mentors can make a difference in whether or not children's expectations can be set higher than they have been. One of the programs that I've been helping to plant throughout the country is called Kids Hope USA. We've been pairing one church congregation with one public elementary school, one adult with one child, to meet with them for an entire year. And we're finding that first group of children that had began mentoring relationships 12 years ago when this program began, they are now finishing high school. Many of these children are children of immigrants. The fact that they are getting an education is going to allow them to be a productive citizen. They will not be depending on public assistance for their staying in this country. And they're more likely to be contributing rather than taking. The net balance of cost and assets shifts through that. There have been charter schools that have been started in Houston as well that are spreading across the nation, one of them called KIPP Academy. It was started in one of the low-income neighborhoods in Houston. I don't know if any of you have watched their success spreading across the country, but they took Hispanic kids, most of whom were not passing the state standardized tests. And within a year, they would have them up to 60%, and within 2 years, they would all be flying over the state minimum standards and actually going on to win millions of dollars of scholarships to prestigious prep schools throughout the country. How do they do it? Longer school day, longer school week, longer school year, highly motivated teachers, very high standards, lots of unorthodox approaches. Every one of their teachers, many of them from Teach From America, wears their cell phone like on a holster, and they're on the phone with kids any time of the day or night, pretty much. Every one of the children has to sign a contract saying they'll finish their homework, they'll read with their parents at night, they'll ask when they don't understand things, and they will succeed. They've turned a group of kids that everybody had given up on, low-income Hispanic kids, and turned them into scholars. This is the kind of thing that I believe holds hope for our nation, and they are now spreading all across the country. They've gotten millions of dollars from the Gates Foundation, from the Gap founders, Fishers, and have really, really shaken up the educational institution in proving that this is a group of kids that we had written off entirely who are fully capable of being excellent students given the extra effort. And because it's a charter school, it's not costing them anything. Amazing. I'm going to skip over a couple of these because I'm aware that we're going to need to move some time. It's no accident that many of the people who have stepped up to take care of the immigrants here are people of faith. There is a long tradition of both Hebrew and Christian teaching which urges us to welcome the stranger. When Oscar Cardinal Rodriguez came from Honduras, he explained the common roots of Jewish and Christian teaching on this point. He said, in honor of God's deliverance of his people, Israel was enjoined to show justice towards all. Example quickly in Houston and one internationally, very briefly. Some of the folks who are in our cities now are fully capable of being productive, but they need additional skill training. Stan Merrick is someone in Houston who's been collaborating with a group that I started, the Work Faith Connection, to take people who are entering the workforce with very low skills and to teach them how to read blueprints, how to learn English, for example, they're doing in their Merrick University, to give them trade skills which will make them actually very productive. The construction industry is hungry for labor. There are not enough Native American-born people who are applying for these jobs. So businessmen have now put together a consortium of other people in construction industries who are at their own expense offering this kind of skill training to folks who are in the nation here. The kind of thing that we've been doing in transitioning them in is linking them then to employers who are willing to give them a chance. And we have 91 employers throughout Houston that are now employing a very high percentage of our 384 graduates. The last thing I want to talk about is microloans. Looking at the international pressures, the one prudent thing that we can do is stabilize the lives of people who are in the countries now, alleviating the pressures for them to leave. Muhammad Yunus, who received the Nobel Prize, pioneered the microcredit approach, and there are a number of smaller organizations, private organizations, that are offering just that. Loans of $50, $100, $200 in a consortium, very often of women, in Latin American countries that allows them to provide for themselves, their family, and to purchase education and health care. These are the kinds of things that I think hold great hope that can stabilize the lives of people in the countries where they are, where they have family rootedness, and to allow them to have productive lives. We need to address the needs of those who are there to allow them to stay, should that be a better choice, rather than sending remittances home. And for those who are here, to invest in them, we can make those immigrants who are here assets to our country rather than liabilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.